We looked in Genesis chapter 2 and found the ideal marriage, God's perfect ideal for the perfect marriage. And now we're looking at Genesis 3 to find out what went wrong, what changed in the fall, so that we can reverse that and know true intimacy again. And what we found is that there were two enemies that invaded human marriage at the fall. Number one is the loss of intimacy that was known in Genesis 2. And number two is the distortion of biblical roles. Now, we began last time looking at the loss of intimacy. In verse 7 of chapter 3, it says, "The eyes of both of them were open, and they realized that they were naked, and so they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves." They exchanged the beautiful intimacy of chapter 2 for privacy. And to develop the Genesis 2 type intimacy now, we need to have that ideal marriage. We need to somehow make the shift from privacy back to intimacy. And we found there are four ways to do that. And I'm sure there's other ways too, but we're just sticking with the implications that we can see here from Genesis 3 itself. We just introduced step one last time, and that is pursue intimacy with God. The first step is always to pursue intimacy with God. If you look at verse 12, it says, "The man said," when he's confronted by God, he says, "The woman here that you gave me, she gave me the fruit from the tree, and I ate it." And he blames his wife. As soon as he's at odds with God, he is at odds with his wife. And so, failure to have intimacy with God will cause us to have problems in our marriage. So, if we want to have intimacy with one another, we need to pursue intimacy with God. And to do that, basically, and we covered this last time, but just to remind you, you need to have intimacy with God, you need to learn from God's Word what He's like. Learn of His character. And then you take those pieces of information and throughout the day, make the connections between those truths about God and your experiences in everyday life. And the more you draw those connections, the more you'll tend to experience God in a moment-by-moment way through your life, day-to-day life, and that will give you a sense of intimacy with God. And that's crucial for marriage. I've counseled many, many couples with marriage problems, and never once have I found a marriage problem that wasn't a spiritual problem. The solution to every marriage problem is always greater intimacy with the Lord and greater spiritual maturity and spiritual growth. So, step one to recovering intimacy with marriage is to pursue intimacy with God. Step two, we see in the purpose of those fig leaves. When we look in verse 7 at why they had the fig leaves, the purpose of the fig leaves was to hide from one another. For the first time in their existence, they were withholding something from each other. And that's what killed the intimacy. If we're going to achieve intimacy in our marriages, we have to reverse that. So, step number two in finding intimacy is give yourself completely to your spouse. Don't withhold anything from your spouse. In 1 Corinthians 7:4, you're familiar probably with that, when Paul was talking about the physical union in marriage, he said in verse 4, "The wife's body does not belong to her alone, but also to her husband. In the same way, the husband's body does not belong to him alone, but also to his wife." Now, that's just basic in marriage. And if that's true of the body, certainly it's true of every other part of you, your heart and your soul and your mind. Intimacy comes when you give all of yourself to your spouse. Physically, what do you have to offer? Physically, you give your body. Spiritually, you give your spiritual gifts. Mentally, you give your thoughts. And that's why accurate communication is so crucially important in marriage. That's what, you know, it's a major way that we give of ourselves, because your thought life is a very large part of your life. And you can't have intimacy unless that part of your life is shared. When we bought our car, we bought a used Saturn, and we took it to a mechanic. First thing he told us is, "You need to replace all the wiring in this thing. There's too much resistance in the wiring, and so we had to have it all replaced." And the reason is because a car can't function right if the signals can't pass through the wiring. In the same way, a marriage can't function right if there's resistance in the communication. The marriage becomes corrupted and stifled if there's not free communication. So this means talking to your spouse, and not only talking to your spouse, but talking to your spouse about what's important to your spouse, and talking about things that are interesting. Failure to do that is a major problem in marriage, and it's a problem on both sides. Both men and women are culprits in this matter of failure to communicate. Men are the notorious culprits. Very often men fail to communicate because, for men, it just takes a lot of effort. I think it takes more effort for a man than for a woman, and we talked about the differences, the way God equipped women in the area of communication. If a woman has a thought or a feeling, generally, she would just as soon talk about it than think about it. Because generally speaking, I think women like to explore an idea by talking it through, whereas men like to explore an idea by thinking it through. And once he's thought it through, he summarizes his conclusions, and he remembers those conclusions, but not necessarily the thought processes. And the last thing he wants to do is rehash and go back over all those thought processes again verbally, after he's already done it mentally. For a woman, it might be just as easy, or even easier, to talk through an idea than it is to think it through, but for a man, it's much harder. He may not even remember all his thought processes, because all he remembered filed away in his memory is his final conclusion. And so the result is, men fail to talk to their wives just simply because it requires effort, and he doesn't want to put forth the effort because he's lazy, and so he just doesn't. Now, as I said, women are also culprits in this. A few weeks ago, we laughed at the woman's dictionary. Remember, we went through that, and we were defining the words, and we found that sometimes the word nothing means something. Right? You know, you have a situation where a woman is upset, but she's too lazy to deal with it, and so you ask what's wrong, and she just says, nothing. Well, we might just write that off as, oh, you know, that's the way women are, whatever, but really, it's more serious than that. That's a lie. And it's a refusal to communicate, and it's a killer to intimacy. Sometimes women will say, well, you know, if I have to tell him what's wrong, that just ruins everything. I just want him to know intuitively. Of course, those same women aren't content to know intuitively what their husbands are thinking. They want their husbands to verbally tell them. But listen, even if that's what you want, you can say that. You can say, I'm thinking something, and I want you to know it, and I'm not willing to tell you what it is. But to say nothing is just a refusal to communicate. Meaningful communication is hard on both sides. Either way, it's difficult, and it requires effort, especially when you're hurt or angry. It can be very difficult to talk something through in a constructive way, and yet it's crucial. It's hard when you're angry, and it's hard when your spouse is angry. Sometimes your spouse is angry and in a terrible mood and impossible to be around, and the normal human reaction to that is just to keep your distance until the thing blows over. But that's not intimacy. The deepest and most profound kind of intimacy is when you are as close to her as ever when she is at her ugliest. It's when you're there by his side, even when he is impossible to be around, and at his worst. And you might be thinking, wow, you know what a drag that sounds like. I mean, I don't know if I want to have that kind of invasion into my privacy. Well, it will cost you something, but just like all of God's standards, they all cost something, but the reward is always worth more than what it costs. There's something, there's nothing quite like having somebody that cares about everything that's happening in your life. It's just a privilege that is a great treasure in life. I mean, if I'm elated about something, I'll tell Tracy. And she'll not only be happy with me, but she'll understand why that particular thing makes me so happy. And if I'm devastated over something, I'll tell her, and she'll understand why that thing is so difficult for me. And she'll show sympathy. And, you know, if I have a need, I have someone else in this world who's on the lookout for a solution to that need, a fulfillment of that, besides just myself. I mean, if anything, the slightest little thing, if I just get a paper cut, I'm not going to announce that to the church. You know, I'm not going to send out an email to all my friends or put it in the newsletter or anything like that, call my parents. I mean, it would be ridiculous to do anything like that because it's such a tiny, insignificant, meaningless little thing. But, you know, I might tell Tracy. And, you know, the funny thing, she'll care. Which, at least she appears to. She acts like she does. She'll even feel a little bit sorry for me. I mean, having somebody else in this life who cares about everything about my life is something that's worth whatever it costs. There are things that I care about in life that nobody knows about because I don't talk to anybody about them, but except for Tracy. I mean, things like I have a concern about if I'm getting to be, you know, a better preacher or a worse preacher or just staying the same or something like that. And Tracy understands that. And so she's part of that aspect of my life. And she understands things like that because of the conversations we've had. So, anyway, step number one is to pursue intimacy with God. Step number two is to give yourself completely to your spouse. And that includes conversation. Step number three, we see, in the motive that Adam and Eve had for making the fig leaves. Back in chapter 2, verse 25, the implication of that verse is when it says that they, before the fall, they were naked and had no shame. Afterwards, they had shame. And the implication is now that's why they sowed the fig leaves, because they had something about themselves that they wanted to hide from one another, because they had a fear that if they were exposed, that there would be some kind of shame or humiliation that they would suffer. You see, the reason that we hide and that we're not totally open with one another is because of the fear of rejection and being hurt. And one thing I can tell you about your spouse may be a wonderful person, but no matter how wonderful your spouse is, it's just a matter of time before your spouse hurts you, because your spouse is sinful. And if you open yourself up completely to your spouse, I guarantee you're going to get hurt. And you have a choice. You can either sow fig leaves over everything and have privacy and safety without real intimacy, or you can become vulnerable and willing to risk pain and enjoy intimacy. So step number three is simply being willing to risk pain. See, in chapter 2, they didn't have the fig leaves. Of course, they didn't need them because there was no risk. Now we have sin, and so we have the risk. But if we remove the fig leaves, so to speak, I mean, if we open ourselves up completely to one another, there's a risk of being hurt. And so if you want to enjoy intimacy, you have to be willing to risk pain. If you share with your spouse your deepest thoughts and your deepest desires, he might laugh himself silly. You know, I mean, if you talk to your husband about how you really feel, he might respond and be harsh with you, or belittle you, or use that against you in some future argument. You're putting yourself at risk. If you confess your sins, your secret sins, to your wife, she may become angry, and she may refuse to forgive, or she may misunderstand and draw all kinds of inappropriate conclusions. Taking off the fig leaves puts us at great risk, no doubt about it. And, you know, it may be appropriate to protect yourself in out in the world. But in marriage, to enjoy the intimacy of Genesis 2, we have to be willing to risk pain and open ourselves up. And so that's step number three. You be willing to risk pain. And then step number four becomes obvious. That is, make it so your spouse doesn't have to risk so much. Make it safe for your spouse. You know, Adam and Eve, before the fall, were just as naked as they were after the fall. They were only concerned about hiding it after the fall, because before the fall, there was no risk. And that's why they could have such intimacy. So you can create a pre-fall environment in your marriage by making hurting you less risky for your spouse. You can do that through unconditional love. Make it less dangerous for your spouse to be honest with you. I mean, ask yourself, what have you communicated to your spouse about that might make it impossible for your spouse to be totally honest with you? Is there a chance that you would leave? If your spouse did something that was bad enough, is there a chance you might leave? Does your spouse have the assurance that no matter what happened, if he's repentant or she's repentant, that you'll forgive no matter what, forgive anything? If you're holding some threat over your spouse, then that will make intimacy impossible in your marriage. Consequences for hurting you, what are they? Are they so severe that your life would be miserable for your spouse if you find out the worst things about him or her? If so, you might as well just put a big sign around your neck that says, whatever you do, do not be honest with me. Because no one can live with constant danger. And everyone will do wrong things from time to time, and sometimes serious things. So if you make it dangerous for your spouse to reveal weaknesses and sins, you're driving your spouse away from you, and you'll never know intimacy. And you might be saying, well, you know, my standards are high. Well, how high are they? Higher than God's? Because I know I can go to God at any time with any sin, and if I'm repentant, He'll forgive. And there may be consequences, but there can also be restored intimacy. Johnny Eadie says, what a union of two believers with one hope, one discipline, one service, one spirit, and one flesh. Together they pray, together they prostrate themselves, and together they keep their fast, teaching and exhorting one another and sustaining one another. They are together at the church and at the Lord's Supper, and they are together in straits and persecutions and refreshments. Neither conceals anything from the other. Neither avoids the other. Christ rejoices on hearing and beholding such things. To such persons He sends His peace. So, if you pursue intimacy with God, if you give yourself completely to your spouse, if you're willing to suffer risk, and you make it less, reduce the risk for your spouse, then you can begin to restore the intimacy that we read about in Genesis chapter 2, that God considers so important, it's so crucially important for illustrating the relationship between Christ and the church. But that's only one problem that came from the fall, the problem of lost intimacy. There's a second problem that was injected into human marriage at the fall, and that is the distortion of biblical masculinity and femininity. And that's what we need to turn our attention to here. And we see this in the curse. If you look at verse 1 of chapter 3, it says, the serpent, look carefully at this, it says, the serpent was more crafty than all the wild animals Yahweh God had made, and he said to the woman, now stop right there. Why does he address the woman? Why does he go after her? Somebody said, well, it's because she was more gullible. Was that why? Is it because she was more gullible? If that were the case, then you would expect the serpent to try and track her down sometime when she was alone, right? If the problem is, if she's, you know, really dumb and Adam is really smart, and so that's why he goes after her, then you would expect that he would do that at a time when she was alone. But he didn't. He did it at a time when they were both together. And we see that later on in the text. He was right there the whole time. Now, why did he do this? I think it's not that the serpent was going after the one that was the most gullible. Now, part of it may be that since man is to be the provider and protector, that the text is presenting her as being more vulnerable in some ways. But more than that, I think what it has to do with is the God-ordained structure of headship and leadership. God designed Adam to be the leader. And if Satan wants to foul up God's plan, the last thing he's going to want to do is go through God's ordained channels of leadership. His goal is to undermine all that, and so he addresses the woman. I think if the woman had been the leader, then he would have gone after the man. Because all he wants to do is foul up God's plan and reverse what God has set in place. And that seems to be even what also is so upsetting to God about it. If you look at the curse, look at verse 17. When God punishes Adam in verse 17, he prefaces the entire punishment by saying this, because you listened to your wife. Now, don't get carried away with that. That's not, the word listened there, it's not to say you should never listen to your wife. The word listen there means obey. In this context, it means because you obeyed your wife. That's the whole thing that Adam did wrong. And so Adam, it's questionable who sinned first, Adam or Eve. Because Adam, from the split second the serpent begins speaking to the woman, the man is facing a temptation, right? I mean, he has a decision to make. Is he going to step in and protect his wife, or is he going to abdicate his God-given responsibility? Right from the very beginning, Adam could have stepped in. I mean, just think of how different things would have been if he would have just, right at the start, as soon as the whole thing started, if he would have just stepped forward and said, listen, snake, we're not having fruit for dinner tonight. We're having, you know, broiled snake, or whatever. Snake and eggs. That would have been the end of it, right? But instead, he just sits on his hands and watches the serpent do the worst conceivable harm to his precious wife without lifting a finger or saying a peep to protect her. He won't take the leadership. He shirks his responsibility and basically says to Eve, you decide. And when we read at the end of verse 6, and then at the end, he ends up blaming her. At the end of verse 6, when we see that Adam was standing there, it's a little startling. You know, when you're reading through the text, and it says, and Adam, who was there with her, and you say, whoa, he's there? I didn't realize that. Because up until then, you assume he's not there because he's just silent. He's just completely quiet. He lets the serpent go on and deceive his wife without saying anything. And so the serpent goes on and he deceives Eve. He uses some smooth talk to get her to doubt God's word. And in verse 6 it says, she took some of the fruit and ate it, and she also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it. So she takes the initiative. Adam follows along. And Ray Ortland says this. He says, isn't it striking that the human race fell on an occasion of the sex role reversal? Are we to repeat this confusion forever? Are we to institutionalize it in evangelicalism in the name of the God who condemned it in the beginning? So, the curse, if we look at the curse involves giving over of Adam and Eve to their sin of the fall. They fell through a reversal of roles. And so the curse involves a further distortion of roles and a difficulty in that area. There's a statement about women's pain in childbearing, and then there's a statement about men's pain in providing. And in between those two statements comes the part of the curse that affects the relationship between the man and the woman. And this is what we want to zero in on. Look at verse 17. Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you. Now, people have debated about what that means. What does it mean, her desire for her husband? Well, turn to chapter 4, and it's very easy to see what it means. The same two words are used in chapter 4, verse 7. It says, God is talking to Cain. He says he's being tempted. Cain is being tempted. And God says, sin is crouching at your door, and it desires to have you, but you must rule over it. Same two words, desire and rule over. The word desire means to desire to dominate. And the word rule over means to master or to dominate. So in chapter 4, he's saying, watch out, Cain. Sin wants to dominate you, but you must dominate it. And so the idea in chapter 3, verse 17, is that the result of the curse is that women will, through the centuries, tend to want to manipulate and control and dominate their husbands, but the result will be their husbands will overwhelm that and dominate them instead. And that's the curse. And so within the curse is a distortion of the roles that were so beautiful in chapter 2. Because of the fall, our natural inclinations in marriage make our God-ordained roles difficult. You understand that? Our natural inclinations make our God-ordained roles difficult for us. Since men are generally stronger physically, they tend to get their way through just being, just overwhelming their wife physically. And that's why women have been so mistreated over the centuries. Women, since they're not as strong, tend to try and gain control through other means. Manipulation, nagging or becoming angry when they don't get their way, or crying or withholding intimacy or whatever means they have. And men just do it through brute strength. And so the result of the fall and the consequence of sin is manipulation and abuse. And when women try to manipulate men and men abuse women, the result of that generally ends up being male domination. And what I mean by male domination is when the man asserts his will over the will of the woman. And so her efforts of manipulation, sometimes, you know, in some cases it's the reverse. Some men would just rather capitulate, and the woman's efforts win out, and she is dominant in the family. But either way, it's tragic, and it ruins the God-ordained plan. And the real tragic thing is, if you listen to marriage counselors and read marriage books, Christian marriage books and everything, they have decided, so many of them, that the solution to this problem is just more sophisticated manipulation techniques. I mean, just think about what you hear in marriage seminars about marriage. Think about what you hear people say. They say, well, men, look, you know, or women, do you want your husband to be more responsive to you and show you more affection and romance and all that stuff? Give him what he wants, and he'll give you what you want. Or men, you want your wives to be more responsive to you? Be more romantic to them, and your wives will be responsive, and you can get what you want. That's just manipulation. That's not love. That's just a business transaction. That's a trade-off. That's just a form of manipulation. You're trying to get your spouse to give you what you want by doing something for them. That's trying to manipulate, and that's just exactly the problem in the curse. I mean, the effort to manipulate is the curse. That's what needs to be reversed. That's the problem that needs fixing. That's the part of the engine that needs to be restored to factory specs. So how can we have an ideal marriage? By fixing the problem in marriage. And the problem is female manipulation and male domination, and so we need to reverse that. And how can it be done? Well, turn to Colossians 3. And the answer is in Colossians 3, and everything for... Actually, this is supposed to be a study of Colossians 3, but we had to take 2.5 weeks to set up the background so that we understand verse 18 of Colossians 3. Everything we've talked about the last couple weeks is all for to understand this. Now look at verse 18. He says, wives, submit to your husbands, as is fitting to the Lord. And husbands, love your wives, and do not be harsh with them. You see how meaningful that is in the context of everything that we've seen up to here? This is not just some cultural tradition that Paul picked up from his day, or some rule out of the blue, or some meaningless roles within marriage. It's a very intentional command targeted directly at the problems that came from the curse. The wife's problem is that her desire is to dominate her husband. And so the solution to that problem is for the wife to be submissive to her husband instead. And the husband's problem is that he rules his wife with harsh domination, and so the solution is to love his wife instead and to not be harsh with her. So another way of saying this in Colossians 3:18 and 19 is, wives, be Genesis 2 type women, and husbands, be Genesis 2 type men, not Genesis 3 type men and women. I mean, this is not just a call for us to get along in marriage. It's a call for us to become paradise people. Genesis 2 type people. I mean, we could use that term instead of what I've been saying. Instead of biblical masculinity and femininity, we could say just be a paradise man or a paradise woman. Paradise man sounds a little bizarre, so we'll stick with biblical masculinity, but you get the idea. Now, that's why this is a crucial point here. That is why all the commands in the New Testament are so focused and directed towards attitudes and not actions. If we were to sum up everything the New Testament says about the husband's role, what one word could we use to sum that up? Somebody just said, quick, I need to know, what is the husband supposed to do to his wife? And you would say, husbands, love. Exactly. Love. That's the good summary. And then the wife's. Well, how do we summarize the wife's role in one word? Now turn to Ephesians 5, because I want to show you this about attitudes. In verse 21, he starts giving instructions to wife. And I'm not going to read it all and go through it all now, but he says wives are to be submissive to their husbands. The motive for doing so is to have reverence for Christ. They are to submit the same way that they would submit to Christ. It's a very extreme idea. They are to recognize the husband as the head in the same way that Christ is the head over the church. They are to take their cues from the church in determining how they respond to their husbands. The way that the church responds to Christ, that's how they respond to their husbands. And they are to respond that way in everything, it says. So all these instructions for wives. And then if you take all that, you sum it up in one word. Somebody says, quick, how are wives supposed to respond to their husbands? What's the one word that would sum that up? And most of you would probably respond, if I gave you a chance, by saying, submit, be submissive. But let's look at how the Holy Spirit himself sums everything up. It's in verse 33. He gives all his instructions to women, and then he gives even more instructions to men, a whole long section of instructions to men, and we'll look at that next week. But then, after all that, he sums, verse 33, the last verse, he just sums all of everything he said all up, and he says this, verse 33, each one of you, therefore, must also love his wife. So we got that one right. Love his wife as he loves himself. That's the summary for the man. But look at the woman. And the wife must, and you expect to submit, but it doesn't come. His wife must respect her husband. You see, the best word to summarize all the woman's responsibility is not submit, it's respect. Now, submission is just one expression of that respect. The respect is the crucial attitude. And that plays itself out in a lot of ways. The issue for women is not to just do what their husbands want them to do. The primary issue for women is to have a heart attitude of respect. And most men, and I don't know if the ladies, if you realize this, but if you ask most men, what do you want from your wife? Very few men that I've ever met would say, what do I want from my wife? Obedience. What do I want from her? To do everything that I say, or to do what I want. Or to serve me, or something. I mean, there's some of that chauvinism that comes in our sinfulness, and we treat each other sometimes with that kind of an attitude. But the deepest craving of a man's heart is not that. The deepest craving of a man's heart from a woman is respect. And I think a lot of women don't realize this, but God designed men to crave respect in the same way that you crave affection. And ladies, I can hardly stress this enough. What your husband craves from you is not obedience or compliance or service. More than anything else, it's respect. Just like you have a strong craving for affection, that's the same kind of craving he has for respect. And it's a strong term here. When it says respect your husbands, the word is fear. It's just the word fear. Wives, fear your husbands. It's a term that describes deep honor and reverence and respect. Now, if you show him affection, he'll like that. If you smile at him from across the room, he'll enjoy that. If you go out of your way to do considerate things for him, and you know, he'll appreciate that. If you do some effort to be romantic and do something romantic, I don't know, he may or may not appreciate that. But nothing will energize him and strengthen him more than if, in a very obvious way, you're just simply impressed with him. And it's obvious. That's how men are wired. And you can just trace it all the way back to when boys start to become men. I mean, you go all the way back to junior high and high school. When guys are out there on the football field, the basketball court, you know, in front of all the girls there watching, what do you think we were out there trying to achieve? You think we're trying to gain love or affection? No, we were trying to impress you ladies. And that desire never changes. I mean, it changes in form over the years, but it remains throughout life. What a man wants and needs more than anything from a woman is not to serve him or anything like that, but it's for her to look up to him, to respect him, and take him seriously and hold him in high regard without him having to earn it. And women are uniquely suited to build up men in this way. A man may have 100 other men at work who highly respect him and who look up to him, but it's all meaningless if he comes home and his wife looks down on him and treats him like a child and talks to him like a child. How many times do I have to tell you to pick up your socks, you know, or whatever? On the other hand, I know from experience that a man can go to work and have everyone at work, including his boss, think he's a complete imbecile, and come home, and if his wife still respects him, he can maintain his dignity if she's impressed with him. And one other thing, you know, turn to 1 Peter 3, because I want to show you that this is what makes a woman beautiful. Great example of a beautiful woman in the Bible, of course, is Sarah. She was incredibly attractive, physically attractive woman, evidently, at age 100. She had kings who were pursuing her even at age 100. And the secret to her beauty and her enduring beauty to last that long is in 1 Peter 3. But look at verse 4. It says, that kind of beauty comes from a spirit that is quiet and gentle. The word gentle is the word meek. It means basically to be non-threatening. She's no threat. The idea is that the man is in no danger of being belittled or looked down upon, but rather he'll be respected and looked up to and strengthened. And the example he gives is Sarah, who, now look at verse 6. Sarah, who called her husband master. Now watch this. This is great. The fascinating thing I think about this is He refers here to Genesis 18. There's one place in the Bible where Sarah calls her husband master, literally Lord. And it's in Genesis chapter 18. And it's very, very significant that Peter refers to Genesis 18 rather than Genesis 20 when he's illustrating submission and obedience. And he actually uses the word obedience here. But you might expect that he would use Genesis chapter 20, because Genesis chapter 20 is a chapter where Abraham told his wife to do something that would be very difficult for her, and she did it. And so you might expect that he would use that example as the greatest example of submission, but he doesn't. He uses chapter 18, and the fascinating thing is in chapter 18, Abraham doesn't tell or ask his wife to do anything. The only thing that happens in chapter 18 is that she uses this term, Lord, in referring to him. I believe that the reason for that is that the greatest expression of submission is not obedience. That can be one expression of submission. But the greatest expression of submission, depending on the attitude, is to speak in these kinds of terms about your husband and to your husband. For her to call him Lord is pretty extreme. That would be like, in our day, for a woman to call her husband sir. Now, any man that would require that of his wife, I think, has a problem. But I also think that any woman that would have a hard time referring to her husband that way also may have a problem with in this area. Perhaps you're a wife, and you've been doing what your husband has wanted you to do, and you're following his lead in external matters, but the fact is you don't really respect him. And it's, or maybe you do, but it's not obvious. If that's the case, then you're not really being submissive. This may sound extreme, calling your husband sir, but it's exactly the attitude that 1 Peter 3 is talking about. And, you know, there are many wives who have just gone to great lengths to do something special for their husband. Maybe they wrote a long letter or cooked some special meal for him or spent a lot of time and energy doing something that would be especially encouraging to him, and they're trying to figure out how they can be pleasing to him. And the truth is, they could have saved themselves a lot of time and effort, and they could have encouraged him 10 times as much by just waiting for a moment when he showed strong godly leadership, and then at that moment looked up to him and responded by saying, "Yes, sir," with a respectful attitude. And depending on what that terminology means to you, it means to your husband, you know, it may or may not be appropriate, but there's no question from this passage that using respectful terminology in general is the way that, in the way that you talk to your husband, is crucial. Another way to show respect, besides just the way you talk, is in trust, with trust. Trust your husband. Trust him to lead. Just trust him. If you acquiesce to his leadership, but the whole time you fret and worry and wring your hands and constantly question whether he's doing the right thing and pressure him to reconsider, that, and that's a general pattern for you, that may be an indication of a disrespectful heart, a failure to trust his leadership. But if you go to him and say, "Look, this is a hard decision. I've given you my opinion. There's a lot at stake. I know you realize there's a lot at stake, and I'm tempted to fret over this, but I'm just going to let you handle it." Not only that, will that make life easier for you as a woman, because it'll lift off of your shoulders a burden that God never designed you to bear, but it's also one of the greatest gifts you could ever give your husband. That is so encouraging. Last week I told you, being an authority is a burden, it's a hardship, it's a difficulty, and it becomes infinitely harder when those under you are constantly supervising you and second-guessing everything you do. But it's incredibly encouraging when people just trust. I got an email recently from somebody in the church who was concerned about a particular situation in the church, and that situation bothered this person, it bothered me, and it was a problem. But it was kind of a dicey situation that required some delicate handling in the way that it was addressed and some timing. And the person who wrote the email gave a full explanation of the concerns, and then that person clearly and respectfully offered an opinion that was very helpful for me in thinking through the issue. And then the email ended with this line, quote, "I trust your timing and your thoughtfulness concerning this issue." I wrote back to that person and said, "You know, there are a lot of people have said a lot of very encouraging things to me in the last few weeks, but I don't remember anything that was as encouraging and motivating as this statement." That's just wonderful to have that as a leader. And your wives, you can't believe what an encouragement it could be to your husbands to just have this attitude. Even though you know that he will make mistakes. Now, underline that in your thinking. To have this attitude of trusting his leadership, even though you know he's going to make mistakes in the way that he leads. You also know that ultimately your whole family is in God's hands, and God can use even your husband's mistakes to lead you where he wants you to be. He can lead you even through a fallible human being. So the issue is respect. And you show respect verbally, and you show respect by trusting his leadership. And then also, you can show respect through obedience. And we don't want to leave that out. It says be submissive. And we've spent a lot of time qualifying that because it's so misunderstood. And we talk a lot about what that doesn't mean. But we don't want to neglect what it does mean. I mean, it does mean to obey. That's what the word means, is to obey. And Peter uses the word obey. The final decision does lie with the man. If the woman is rebellious against that, she's in sin. The temptation of this passage is to always try and soften that truth and to sort of make it milder and try and fit it more closely into our egalitarian culture that we live in so that it doesn't offend people because it's unpopular. But it's unpopular, do you see this? It's unpopular because of the curse. Makes it unpopular. Because of the curse, our desire is to dominate each other. And so this message of wives submit and husbands love is not going to be popular in any culture. We ought not to cave into our culture and understate what the Bible clearly says. In fact, in Ephesians 5 here, Paul just absolutely goes out of his way to make this as strong as it can possibly be made. The word submit, means to obey. In Ephesians 5, he says the husband is the head of the wife as Christ is the head of the church. He says the church submits to Christ as Savior. Therefore, wives should really submit in following the church's cues. As the church submits, wives should submit in everything. He says submit to your husbands as to the Lord, which is the strongest statement of all. I mean, how are we supposed to submit to the Lord? I put a list there in the back of your bulletin. You can look at the ways that we're supposed to submit to the Lord. I mean, out of love, completely, for the purpose of serving Him, doing His will, submit out of fear, delighting in His commands, wholeheartedly, permanently, immediately, eager to learn how, with loyalty and allegiance, as your only master, profitably, patiently, working, following, doing it above every other authority, serving from the heart as a way of life, when unsupervised, out of intimate knowledge, do it to please Him. By loving His children, you serve Him, you submit to Him. Submit carefully. It's the opposite of forgetting Him. It's doing it in a worthy manner, not just to please men, but doing it without stain, doing it joyfully, all these things. And it's all summed up in the Shema, Deuteronomy 6:5. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. That's how the church is called to submit to Christ. And it says, wives, in that same way, be submissive to your husbands. I don't see any possible way Paul could have put this in any stronger terms than he put it. Now, there are times when it's appropriate for a husband to tell his wife to do something, and she must do it, and it would be a sin for her not to, and it's not appropriate for a wife to tell her husband to do anything. But again, we want to emphasize that the goal in all this is not actions only. Our goal is to generate a certain attitude in the context of a love relationship. You submit in the context of a love relationship, and that is, I mean, that makes all the difference in the world. In fact, look at verse 22 of Ephesians 5. It says, wives, be submissive to your own husbands. Now, did you ever wonder why that word own is in there? Your own husbands? Is Paul worried that the women are going to be confused and they won't know which husband to submit to? And so he has to say, oh, it's your own. I mean, obviously, that's not. Obviously, he knows you're going to know which husband to submit to. I think the purpose of this word is to highlight the intimacy of the relationship. It's not just some detached, distant, mechanical response to an impersonal authority out there somewhere. It's a loving responsiveness to a man, your own man, who belongs to you alone, with whom you enjoy intimate love relationship. And that's why we never see anywhere in the Bible any statement to the man saying, man, cause your wife to submit. Now that's interesting, because we do see that in other authority submission relationships. We see parents are told to cause their children to be submissive. Governments are told to cause their citizens to be submissive under threat of punishment. But there's nothing like that for the husband to cause his wife to be submissive. There's no punishment or any threat of that or anything. All it says is husbands love your wives and be gentle with them. It's voluntary submission. Now don't get confused there. That's not to say it's optional. It's required scripturally, but it's voluntary. It's not forced upon her by a threat of punishment. The motivation is not punishment, but intimacy. There's something very special about the submission that a wife shows to her husband because of the fact that it's voluntary. I mean, my kids submit to me because there's consequence if they don't, but Tracy submits to me just because she chooses to. And this is something that men should keep in mind. Because as men, remember, we're to take our cues from Christ in the way that we treat our wives. Now, if anyone had the right to force obedience and submission, it was Christ. And yet He didn't. Instead, what did He choose to do? He chose to win our hearts. He wooed us. Like He's trying to, I mean, like, as if He had to do that. I mean, of course He didn't. But He chose to. Chrysostom, in commenting on this passage, Ephesians 5, he talks all about submission. And then he says this, have you seen the measure of obedience? Here also the measure of love. Do you want your wife to obey you as Christ obeys the church? Then care for her as Christ for the church. And if it be needful that you should give your life for her, or be cut to pieces 1,000 times, or endure anything for her, refuse it not. He brought the church to His feet by His great care, not by threats or fear or any such thing. So do you conduct yourself also toward your wife. And wives, the big hindrance to this is going to be fear. It's a scary thing to place your well-being in the hands of a sinful, fallible leader. What if he makes foolish decisions? What if he leads you the wrong way? What if he takes advantage of you? And so you got fear that's going to hold you back. And look at 1 Peter 3 again. Because 1 Peter 3 addresses that in verse 6. He says, when he calls the women to be submissive there and obedient and respectful to their husbands, he says, do not give way to fear. Just submit and let God protect you. He'll not only protect you, but he'll use your respectful, submissive attitude to be that protection. In fact, skip back up to verse 1 and look at it. It says that kind of attitude will tend to win over even an unbelieving husband. I mean, even in the non-Christian man, there's something very humbling about having a woman be respectful to you and submissive. If you accuse your husband, he'll become defensive. If you nag your husband, he'll become angry. But when a woman respects a man and submits to him and speaks to him with respectful terms, that's very humbling to the man, and it's even a little awkward, actually. And that, more than anything else, will tend to make him seek to be worthy of that respect and to treat her with tenderness and to even become saved if he's an unbeliever. So your very willingness to be vulnerable and submissive ends up being your protection. Okay, and then finally, he wraps up by saying, as is fitting to the Lord, back in Colossians 3. He says, wives, be submissive to your husbands as is fitting. And some people have misunderstood this. They think it means, the statement in Ephesians 5 is a little more vague. He just says, wives, be submissive to your husbands in the Lord. And some people misinterpreted that in the Lord as if it meant, wives, only follow your husband when he's acting like the Lord would act. The result is, women only submit when they agree with their husbands. And so in effect, the verse ends up saying, wives, go along with your husband only when you agree. Which would be a meaningless command because of course you're going to do that. Everybody goes along with anybody as long as they agree with them. The commands in the Bible to submit are always targeted towards when you don't agree. That's why we need the command. The phrase, as is fitting to the Lord, doesn't mean that. What it means is, it's fitting as a believer, being in the Lord, being a Christian. It's fitting that submission to your husband is a function, not primarily of marriage, now get this, it's primarily a function of your relationship with the Lord. It's a function not of marriage, but of Christianity. It's your duty, not primarily as a wife, but as a daughter of God. It's a matter that has to do with, not with your relationship with your husband, but with your relationship with Christ. A husband's authority is not an earned authority. It's a delegated authority. And so rebellion against that authority is not rebellion against your husband, it's rebellion against Christ himself. When a wife's not submissive to her husband, it's because there's something wrong with her relationship to the Lord. And some women say, wait a minute, if he fails to love me, do I still have to be submissive? We'll turn the question around. If you fail to be submissive, does he still have to love you? Of course. Your duty towards your spouse is not a function of what your spouse deserves. It's a function of what Christ deserves. The world will tell you that being under authority is demeaning for a woman. And yet, I think deep down, even the world understands that there is high honor in submission. And the reason I know that is because when the world wants to depict honor, you just look at Hollywood, look at the movies that come out. When they want to depict high honor, how do they do it? It's almost always through movies about the military, where men are submissive to other men and respectful to other men. I think even the world understands deep down that there's a high honor in submission. And the reason there's so many movies about the military is because there's something majestic about the way that they interact. I mean, you can have a high-ranking officer right in the middle of giving orders, and a higher-ranking officer walks in the room, everybody stands up, and there's immediate respectful response, and they'll stand at attention, and they'll salute, and they'll say, yes, sir, and they'll immediately obey, and that's not demeaning at all, it's honorable. And the picture of the New Testament is even more wonderful than that, because it's not the military, but it's a picture of a body. A body responding to the head. It's a warmer illustration, but it's just as honorable. The man functions in the marriage like the head functions in the body.